Let's get into the sermon for the day. And I have just a little brief thing I'll read here as a part of this sermon too. But let me get to my text here to start off with. Have you ever wondered why the word heart is used so many times in the Bible? You find it from practically the beginning to the end. In fact, there are 830 times the word heart is used where it's translated heart. There are many other cases where it's translated in other ways, and it's still the same word, lab, meaning heart from the Hebrew, and then the Greek word, which we don't need to get into those aspects of it, the technicalities. But anyway, I was just reading Ann Landers this morning, or I guess Dear Abby, and she was talking about this woman was writing in about this no good, low-life bum of a husband of hers who's unfaithful to her, and she just can't help but love him. And she was advised, you know, you better use your head and not your heart. And that's the trouble with so many people, especially women. They're just victims of their hearts instead of their heads. Now, I don't want to start off with a negative thing like that, but it nevertheless is a fact. Now, did God know something about the heart that human beings haven't understood or known? Why would it be used 830 times in a number of different applications and ways if there wasn't something significant about it? Well, here's an article from the internet on the matter of heart, and here's what it's entitled. Does your heart sense your emotional state? And only reading just a few sections of this. Of all the bodily organs, the heart plays particularly the most important role in our emotional experiences. The experiences of emotion result from the brain, heart, and body acting in concert. How many times do you have this feeling here? Something emotional come up, and where do you feel it? You don't feel it in your head. You feel it right here in your midsection in your heart. The whole that particular area there. A number of studies have provided new insight into understanding how the activity of the heart is indeed linked to our emotions and our health, vitality, and well-being. I think you all know very well, people sometimes just die of fright. Their heart just quits working. That's how it can affect you. The research explains how the heart responds to emotional and mental reactions and why certain emotions stress the body and drain our energy. As we experience feelings like anger, frustration, anxiety, and insecurity, our heart rhythm patterns become more erratic. The heart starts acting on it. This is interesting too, see, because when you become all emotionally involved in something and your heart is responding to the stimuli provided by the brain, or that is, it came in and then you responded through your brain, the erratic heart rhythms also block the ability to think clearly. You know what they say about somebody who falls in love? It's akin to a mild form of insanity. They don't think straight. And as you've heard oftentimes, love is blind. And that certainly is true. People who often experience stressful emotions such as irritation, anger, and frustration, these emotions create a chain reaction to the body. Stress hormone levels increase, blood vessels constrict, blood pressure rises, and the immune system is weakened. When we experience heartfelt emotions like love, this is also interesting. Love, care, appreciation, and compassion, the heart produces a very different rhythm. Harmonious heart rhythms, which reflect positive emotions, are considered to be the indicators of cardiovascular efficiency and nervous system balance. So they've seen very clearly the relationship between emotions and thinking and the heart. All right, let's get into the scriptures now. We have a number of applications, I think probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I've got 10 different applications here, how the word heart is used in the Bible and how every single one of them are demonstrated very clearly. Now, first of all, the obvious, the heart is the organ of the body. It's an organ of the body. We all know that. This size, we'll give you a couple of examples. In Exodus 28 and verse 28, Exodus 28 and verse number 29, here we read of Aaron. He'll bear the names of the sons of Israel on the breastplate of judgment over his heart. See, remember he wore the Urim and the Thummim? That particular, what would I want to call it? It functioned in giving the answers when they were asking God for answers. That it would light one way or the other, depending on how God was answering it. He wore it right on his breast, right over his breast here, over his heart. It says here, so that's referring to the organ of the body. And then we notice 2 Samuel 18. I think it is. May only be sure. Sometimes I get 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel mixed up. Yeah, this one's correct here. 2 Samuel 18 and verse number 14. You remember when Absalom revolted, and then he's got his hair, long hair, caught in the oak tree, and he was hanging from the tree and couldn't get loose? Joab said, "I cannot linger with you." And he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive. That's the literal heart. The body refers to, I mean, the Bible refers to that on a number of occasions. Now let's go to Psalm 38 and verse number 10. Psalm 38 and verse number 10. And we read here, "My heart pants, my strength fails me." And the actual Hebrew word there for pants means throbs. My heart throbs. So this is talking about the literal heart, isn't it? Because it's an emotional experience that he feels for God. "Lord, all my desire is before you." And he's referring again to these feelings he has in a relationship with God. And then in Psalm 37, verse number 15, we read, again, here's referring to the literal heart, "Their sword shall enter their own heart." So that's a literal body, that's the literal bodily organ. Now, it's used to refer to the inner part or the middle of a thing. Now, when we refer to the human body and we're referring to the emotions that that stimulate the activity of the heart, that's what we're referring to, the inner part or the middle of a thing. But it's used in other ways too. Notice Matthew 12, verse number 40. This is an example I want to illustrate to you. Matthew chapter 12 and verse number 40. "As Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." The middle, meaning the inner part. And of course, this refers to the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, where he was placed after his crucifixion. And in Matthew 15, verse number 18, and this is found in more than one passage here in the Gospels, but this was certainly illustrated. "Those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile the man. For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, and blasphemies." Now, we know that an attitude in the frame of one's mind is certainly paramount in that, but in this particular case here, it just refers to the inner part. And I'll point out a little bit later on a little bit more applications of this as it refers to man's processes. In Psalm 119, verse number 11, Psalm 119, verse number 11. "Your word I have hidden in my heart." So he has taken this word and incorporated it into a heart, into his being, into his thinking. And we'll proceed as we go along with that. Now, another application of the heart is the inner man is contrasted with the outer man. In other words, you can have a certain outward appearance. We all say, you know, you have a private persona and you have a public persona. Well, they're two different things, aren't they? And often the private persona is quite a different picture than the public persona. And that's exactly what we're going to see here. Because notice this is a prime example. What I've tried to do is select those passages that are the most obvious. There are many other passages that apply in these various categories, but I've got the ones that are, you couldn't miss, help but understand them. Here, for example, in 1 Samuel 16, and you should remember this one very well. 1 Samuel 16 and verse number 7. The Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or his physical stature, for I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man does, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." See, the inner man is contrasted with the outer one. And people make very serious mistakes when they fail to recognize that, and they this often happens when people, quote, fall in love. They see a certain person, they're smitten. And then they're only looking at the, you know, if you consider a whole person, whether a man or a woman, you know, and you're looking at a 100 percentile, and they see the outward appearance, and they're maybe looking maybe at 5% of the whole thing. 5% of the whole person. Then when they get married, lo and behold, they got 95% they didn't even need dawn on them existed. And then a lot of times, it fails to work because that 95% is not compatible. And that's a part of the problem because they look at the outer man instead of the inner man. Now, let's go to Joel, the second chapter, and here's another example of what I'm talking about. Joel chapter 2 and verse number 13. Well, let's pick it up in verse 12 here. "Turn to me with all your heart, with fasting and weeping and with mourning, and rend your heart, not your garments." So the outward thing to do is, the outward sign was they would rent their garments or rend their garments. But that's not what God wanted rended. He wanted the inner man as opposed to the outer one. And in Proverbs, the 23rd chapter, and verse number 7, Proverbs 23, verse 7, "So as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you." He presents an outward picture, but that's not really what's on the inside. And in Matthew 15, verse number 8, Matthew 15, verse number 8, "This people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." So there's a great contrast between the outer man, what you see on the surface, and what really is the case inside. Also, now the heart represents the seat of desire, the inclination that one may have, or one's will. The seat of desire. That's mentioned many times in the scriptures. Let's notice an example here back in Exodus 8, verse number 15. Exodus 8 and verse number 15. "When Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not heed them, as the Lord had said." Now, I'll point out a little bit later on here, the Lord is really the one that has a large effect on the heart of man. And in this, he intervened with Pharaoh, but he intervened with Pharaoh because that was Pharaoh's inclination to begin with. What was his inclination? He hardened his heart. Now, I suppose someone in Pharaoh's place would have done the same thing, because look what kind of an economic disaster this would have meant for the whole nation if these people would have been freed. Their whole economy was based on slave labor, just like the Romans did. The Romans' entire economy was dependent upon looting other countries, taking all the goods out of those countries, enslaving those people, and putting them into slavery and making them work for the Romans. If that was ever a society and a civilization that needed to be brought down, that was it. It was an evil, wicked system. So here we see very plainly that it was a desire, a wrong desire, but he hardened his heart. And that's because he hardened his desire was hardened, his inclination, and his will was settled. Now here's a good example here. Here in Exodus 35, in verse number 5, Moses says, "Take from among you an offering to the Lord. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it as an offering to the Lord, gold and silver and bronze," and so on and so forth, it says. Whoever has a willing heart, what's the inclination? What is this man's will to do? And in verse number 21 of the same chapter here, we read, "Then everyone whose heart was stirred, and everyone whose heart was willing, they brought to the Lord. They brought the Lord's offering." And then, in verse number 29, we read here: "The children of Israel brought a free will offering to the Lord. All the men and willing whose hearts were willing to bring material for all kinds of work which the Lord, by the hands of Moses, had commanded to be done." So there was a willingness, an inclination, a desire in that direction. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 19. And verse number 3, here's another example of the heart. Here is this particular king here. I think it's Jehoshaphat in this case here. And here's what we read. He made some mistakes here. And even though he made these mistakes, here's what God inspired the prophet to tell him: "Nevertheless, good things are found in you, in that you have removed the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek the Lord." You prepared your heart. Your inclination was in that direction. Now, the heart is often spoken of as the seat of emotions. And I think I've already demonstrated that very plainly just by what has been found out in various medical experiments to determine how the heart reacts in situations. But here is one example here, Psalm 143, and verse number 4. "My spirit is overwhelmed within me, my heart within me is distressed." So whatever outward stimuli affected the man's thinking and brain, the response was in his heart. You don't feel it in your brain, or you feel everything is right here. And you all know that, because you experience that all the time. And in Judges 6, verse number 25, let's pick up this example here. Judges 6 and verse number 25. Well, I did it again. I went over these scriptures, and I was pretty sure that I had checked all of them to be sure I have the right one, so I'll have to have Cynthia just to delete that particular section there. I've got two others that are will be sufficient to illustrate that. But let's go, first of all, here now to Acts 2, verse number 37. There's two very good examples in the New Testament. I'm going to do one thing here, though, before I give up on this one. I'm going to check 16. Yeah, you'll have to excuse me, folks. Old age is setting in. I thought to myself, I must have left that one off here. Yeah, 16 and verse number 25. It happened when their hearts were merry that they said, call for Samson. So this is another example. It shows you that down in their hearts they were feeling happy. And then in Acts 2, verse number 37 here, there's two good examples right here, fairly close together here in the book of Acts. Acts 2, verse number 37. Here's where Peter was preaching his first really inspired sermon here. And as we read here in verse number 37, now when they heard this, they were cut to the heart. So it just pierced them. And you've had that happen to you. We've all felt these emotional experiences by things we hear or see and experience. So this is an example of how the heart is reflects the emotions or how the mind has generated a response. And then in Acts 7, verse number 54, here was Philip, in this particular case here, Stephen. And we read here, when they heard these things, because he really laid into them into what the facts were, when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, and they gnashed at him with their teeth. So that's another example. Now, the heart also refers to the mind. It uses a reference to the mind. Let's notice, in other words, as the seat of knowledge. And so we're looking at the mind when we look at these particular texts here. In Deuteronomy chapter 29, we read here, Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse number 4. Here's what God says. The Lord has not given you a heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear to this very day. You don't perceive. So that's referring to your mind. That's how the word is used there. And another example is in 1 Kings chapter 3 here. You're all, again, familiar with this one, but this is a very good example of it. 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse number 9. Therefore, here's what Solomon prays. Give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? He wanted an understanding heart. Now, you all know very well, the heart is not going to be evaluating knowledge and information and then processing it in one way or the other. So this is really talking about the mind. And then, of course, the emotions can well be affected. But in John 13, verse number 2, John 13 and verse number 2. Supper being ended, which is not the best translation at all. It should be translated, and suppering, while they were suppering, because it's aorist, middle, participle, middle. And and the suppering, or while suppering, the devil already having put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. That's talking about the mind. So that's how he was influenced by it. And then in Romans chapter 10, verse number 10, here's another example of it. Romans 10, verse number 10. For with the heart one believes unto righteousness, and with the mouth confession is made to salvation. So it's in the mind and the heart where one is able to perceive these things. And if it isn't happening there, it's not going to take place. So that's another example of how the heart is used in the Bible. Now here's another one, because this one is going to have a greater effect probably on our salvation these next four are probably going to have a greater effect on our salvation than anything else. And that is, the heart is a seat of one's conscience and one's moral character. Moral character. Notice Genesis 20, verse number 5. Genesis 20 and verse number 5. And this is a good example here, because it shows you it's very important in the definition of one's moral character. Now, you have to understand that back in those days, these pagan nations there had a different set of morals and standards than I guess Arabs are probably the only ones today who they may not be the only. We have a large segment of our, well, say large, but a pretty good segment of our society that practice the same thing, and that is polygamy. And these particular kings here, they had their harems of women, and in this particular case here, this king took Sarah. And it was revealed to him in a dream that he had better lay off. And I don't mean that wrongly. He'd better just leave this woman alone. And notice what he said here now when this came to him. Genesis 20 and verse number 5. Did he not say to me, she's my sister? That's what Abraham said, see? He told a half-truth because he was fearful. She is my sister, and he herself said he's my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency in my hands, I've done this. So in the honesty of his own heart, he took her in to include her as his harem. And it was forbidden, of course, to take another man's wife. Here's a lot of people don't understand this. Polygamy was never sanctioned in the Old Testament by God. It was permitted, but it was never sanctioned. God never once ever told them that's a proper thing to do. And in every single case in the Bible where you find polygamy, examples of polygamy, it has very bad effects. It's never good. And you pay the price for it. In this particular case here, the king said, in the integrity of his heart, in his honesty, and his conscience and his moral character, he did not do that deliberately. He did it through ignorance. And 2 Samuel 24 and verse number 10. 2 Samuel 24 and verse number 10. This was a case, remember, where he allowed Joab to, well, Joab didn't want to do it. He drug his feet on it because he had enough, I think. David was inspired, as it says here. The anger of the Lord was aroused against him, and he moved David against him to say, go number Israel and Judah. And the main fault with this whole thing was it puts one in complete confidence in his large army. And it draws one away from God. And he was being tested here. And he insisted on doing it. And God has certainly found displeasure with the people. And so you read here, Job gave, this is verse 9, gave the sum of the number of the people to the king. And there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword. And in Judah, 500,000 out of over 1 million men in arms. And David's heart condemned him after he had numbered the people. Yeah, his conscience bothered him. And he realized it should not have been done. What did he say? I have sinned greatly in what I've done. And, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I've done very foolishly. And then God gave him three choices as to what the result was going to be. So it shows you very plainly here that he was stricken in his conscience, and he realized he had done the wrong thing. Matthew 5, verse number 28. Let's notice this example in the New Testament here. Matthew 5 and verse number 28. I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Yeah, his moral characters come into question. So again, it's very, very applicable, as we see here both in the Old and in the New Testaments. Notice Luke 8, number chapter 8, verse number 15. Luke 8, verse number 15. Here he's talking about the parable of the seed. We pick it up here in verse number 11. See, he explained it publicly, but the people didn't understand it, and then the disciples wanted to know privately because they said, what does a parable mean? I remember one time years ago, I was down in Springfield, Missouri, and this couple just began to argue with me almost vehemently that these parables were given to make people understand. That's how much they knew about the Bible. You get people get these religious ideas in their mind, they're just going to stick with them, and they don't give a hoot of what the truth is. And Jesus said very plainly, it is given to you to know, but to them it is not given. That's why I speak to them in parables, very plainly. I read that to them, meh. They weren't interested. So it just shows you. Here he says, it is given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God, but to the rest it is given in parables. Why? Quoting the scriptures, seeing that they may see and hearing, they may not understand. That's why it was done that way. It was only given to the disciples. Now, he says, here's a parable of the word. And then you have here those by the wayside. And it explains, they're the ones, and this is also interesting too, notice this. These by the wayside are the ones who hear, and then the devil comes and takes away the word out of their hearts. So they had some emotional attachment to it, all right. It came into their minds, and then there was a response, and they had the feeling toward it. But what happens? The devil takes it away, lest they should believe and be saved. And the ones on the rock are those who they hear the word with joy, and they have no root. They believe for a while, and then in time of temptation or trial, they fall away. And the ones that fell among the thorns, they're the ones that hear it. They go out and they're choked with cares and riches and pleasures of life and bring no fruit to maturity. They're more interested in the physical things in this life than they are in the spiritual overcoming and qualifying for God's kingdom. All of these things in this physical life, they're so temporary. You know, when you were a little kid and you sat in the sand pile and played with a truck, that was the most important thing in your life at that time, wasn't it? Well, if some kid would have tried to take that truck away from you, there'd be a fist fight, wouldn't there? Now, as you got to be a teenager, how important was that? Well, pre-teenager, what was the most important thing to you? Your bicycle. Boy, you could just ride all over the place and pop wheelies with that bicycle and just have a great time. Then all of a sudden you got old enough to go to drive a car, and how important was a bike to you after that? And so it goes on through life. And at every juncture point in life, things are important to you. Then at the end, when you become old, all those things you were so interested in and had such a desire for, they don't amount to anything anymore. So how long is life? And as Jesus said, what are you going to gain if you gain the whole world and then lose your own soul? And people are so wrapped up in these physical things, that's all they live for. They don't realize that there's something far more important than that. Now, am I saying there's nothing important in the physical things? I'm not saying that. But I'm saying if you make those things first, you're making a big mistake. So that's what he points out here. So what do you read here in verse 15? This is the one I want to emphasize. The ones that fell on the good ground are those who, having heard the word with a noble and good heart. Yeah, that's right. These are the people who have moral character. What do? they keep it and bear fruit with patience. It's a lifelong process. Or as the actual Greek means there, those who have an honest and good heart. They're sincere and they have the right kind of a spirit and attitude, and they have the moral character that it takes to be a member of God's kingdom. Now we have the next one here, and this is one that is found many times in the Bible, and it's something we need to be aware of. Let's go back here to Isaiah, the 14th chapter. And this will illustrate what I mean here. Isaiah 14, and this is a prime example. This set it all in motion. And what I'm talking about here is a heart reflects and represents the seat of pride and rebellion. That's a part of human nature. Pride and rebellion. What do we read here in Isaiah 14, verse number 13? Verse 1, how are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer? That was Satan's name before he fell. How you are cut down to the ground, you who discomforted the nations. You talk about a being that has discomforted the nations. Well, I should say so. You said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit in the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Pride and rebellion, wasn't it? He said it in his heart. Actually, he said it in his mind, but his heart, his emotions and his whole drive and his whole attitude was bound up in this seat of pride and rebellion. Now you read Jeremiah 17 and verse number 9. What does it say about man? Man is very similar. He just doesn't have the same kind of capability and power. But here's what we read in 17 verse 9. The heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. That's a carnal, unconverted man. You know what? What would you think is in the heart of these men that I mentioned in these news items who take these innocent girls, most of them, a good percentage of them from Eastern, when you come to talk about Britain, you're talking about girls that are coming from Eastern Europe, Eastern European countries, or the large numbers that are brought into this country from Mexico, all illegally, of course, and enslave them into prostitution. What do you think is in the hearts of these men? They don't care about anything except themselves and making money. That's the God they worship. That's the sad indictment we have in this world society. But that same attitude and spirit manifests itself everywhere and everything you can think of practically, one way or the other. So it's deceitful. It's crooked above all things and it's desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who can really have knowledge of it? Who can really be wise as to what it's all about? I tell you, when you begin to get understanding of what the human heart is all about, when we're talking about this pride and wickedness, that's when you begin to learn about the truth. How many of you, before you ever understood the truth, realized how evil human nature really is? Very few. When you gain some truth, though, you begin to evaluate it and see, you know, it's a mixture of good and evil, of course. The sad part about it is you have a society that is just bent on destruction, bent on every evil thing, and you have a media that's just stirring it up constantly. And one of the most wicked sources of evil in this world is the media, the modern-day media. They could have made television such a marvelous, wonderful thing, you know, and that it will be in God's kingdom. Every single thing will be edifying and upbuilding and refreshing and good and wholesome. It isn't going to be all this stuff you hear nowadays. Now, my wife always gets mad at me because I'm watching these crime shows. Well, I tell you, the reason I do it is the bad guys always get it in the end, so it gives me a little hope. But I'll show you, this human nature is, you know, the heart of man is really wicked. Now in Romans 2, verse number 5, go clear back to the very beginning. And what do we read here? Romans 2, verse number 5. According with your hardness and impenitent heart, you are treasuring up for yourself wrath in the day of wrath and the revelation of the righteous God, of judgment of God, who will render to each one according to his deeds. Yes? Accordance with your hardness and impenitent heart. That's man's nature, isn't it? Now, going back to the... Well, I'm going to put my finger here in Matthew 15, because I'll be coming back to that in just a moment or two. But let's go first to 2 Chronicles 12. And this is a good example of what the heart can be. 2 Chronicles 12 and verse number 14. Second Chronicles 12 and verse number 14. Here we're reading about Rehoboam, and remember who he was. He was the son of Solomon. After Solomon died, he took the throne. And Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem. The city, this is in verse number 13 of 2 Chronicles 12, the city which the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. Verse 14, and he did evil because he did not prepare his heart to seek the Lord. He had no inclination for it. And he had this rebellious, this pride. And you remember what happened when God set up the revolt there and the 10 tribes of the north broke away because of his foolishness and because God, of course, used him in that extent. And in Matthew 15, verse number 19, those things which proceed out of the heart, out of the mouth, come from the heart. Now, consider this. You have emotional feelings, usually one way or the other, when you're talking to people. You may be not upset about anything, and you're just relating facts and having conversations, and you don't have any particular feeling in your chest area where the seat of the emotions are always seem to be. And that's very interesting in its own self. If you stop and consider, if God was going to put emotions in man, where's the logical place he'd put it? Your arm? Your leg? Right here. Right in the midsection. That's where you feel it. And so if you get angry with someone, you're talking to someone and you're angry, do you feel emotions? You certainly do. And the words that you are portraying reflect that. If on the other hand, you have good feelings, your happiness and joy, and there's affection, you'll feel that as well, won't you? That's why it says here, those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart. And under normal conditions, they defile the man. For out of the heart proceed, and that lists all these things. So it shows you once again here that this whole attitude of pride and self-will and arrogance and rebellion and hatred against criticism, all this kind of thing, it's a part of man's very nature. But you feel it right here, don't you? All right, now, the heart in the Bible actually stands for the man himself. Let me give you some examples. Let's go back to Genesis 17 and verse number 17. And this is a good example of it. 17, verse 17. Here, God told Sarah, you will not call her name Sarai, but Sarah you shall call her name. And this is verse number 16, Genesis 17, verse 16. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her, and I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings and people shall be from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old? So the heart's actually referring to him. Here's another example in Ecclesiastes 1, verse number 16. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse number 16. I communed with my heart, saying. Now, how could you commune with your heart? So you're communing with yourself. You're thinking something through yourself, and you're coming to this conclusion. Saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. So he's referring to himself, isn't he? Here's another example, Psalm 25, verse number 17. Psalm 25, verse number 17. The troubles of my heart have enlarged, bring me out of my distress. Now he's feeling great emotional feelings here, isn't he? So the troubles of his heart, in other words, he's referring to this experience of what he himself is going through. And in Jeremiah 4, verse number 4. Jeremiah 4, verse number 4. Circumcise yourselves to the Lord and take away the foreskins of your heart, you men of Judah. So he's talking to them. Circumcise yourselves. See, what he wanted was a change in the heart of man. And that's why you read in the New Testament when Paul is referring to who a spiritual Jew is. He said he's not one physically, not circumcision of the flesh, but one who is circumcised spiritually, and whose heart and mind has really been changed. Now, the last one I want to point out, this is important. God has a direct influence over your heart. And I'm not talking about the physical heart. I'm talking about the being, the man. I'm talking about the summation of these things I've covered. Now, let me give you an example. I said earlier that Pharaoh had this inclination last thing in the world he wanted to do was to let those Israelites go free. It would have affected the whole society, economy, and it did. Egypt fell from that time on, was taken over by all indications by the Edomites, who were called Hyksos, and ruled it for a number of years. In fact, it's rather interesting if you consider it. The historians say that the people who settled in Sparta, remember that militant state in Greece, those people actually came from Egypt, and they were Edomites. Now that may well be true, because it was a true warrior society. If there was ever a warrior society that's been any more severe than Sparta was, I would like to know which one it was. Anyway, as you read here in Exodus 7, verse number 3, I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders. So God intervened in his case, but he didn't intervene on the basis of what this man's inclination already was. Because we read, when things were tough, he was ready to let Israel go, and then as soon as it eased up a little, what did he do? It doesn't say God caused him to do that. He did that himself. So certainly God has an influence over the heart. Now, here's another example in 1 Samuel 10. 1 Samuel 10 and verse number 4. 9, 1 Samuel 10. Remember, here was Saul. He was chosen to be king. And he was told here now, you'll go down to Gilgal. That's where the tabernacle was located. The tabernacle of the wilderness was located at that time. Surely I'll come down to you to offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait till I come to you and show you what you should do. And so it was. When he had turned his back to go from Samuel, that God gave him another heart. That's right. He didn't give him a physical heart. He didn't do anything. He didn't do anything different physically to him in any manner, shape, or form. But he changed the way this man thought and what his attitude and frame of mind was. Now, God can certainly do that. But I don't know of a single example, unless you can cite one to me, where God ever took some wicked, evil man and gave him a different heart. In Saul's case here, he was, at this point, neutral. He wasn't against God, and he wasn't against David. He only became that way later after he gained power, and then he didn't want to give it up. And he wanted his dynasty to continue, and God took it away from him because he'd proven himself unworthy of it. God's promises to him were certainly conditional. But to Abraham, they were unconditional. And in Ezekiel 36:26, here's another example of what God is going to do and what his influence of the heart is. But you know, this is going to come about as a result of a world that's been cleansed of all this wickedness. And I just praise God. If I'm privileged to be a part of it, I'm going to jump up and down in joy when I see all this modern media destroyed and moved. We get rid of this terrible thing that goes on, the terrible thing that goes on in this media world. Does that mean every bit of it? No. There's a lot of good things there. But there's far too many things. I'll just give you an example here. I don't know how many times I've actually read this and seen this. You see it on the internet. I read it on the internet and you see it on the news. Here's some Hollywood movie star who now's pregnant. And lo and behold, she's going to marry her boyfriend. And the media just raves over it. Just wonderful. She's going to have a baby. I'll tell you what she's going to have. A bastard child. That's the way God views it. Now, does he hold it against the child? No, he doesn't. But nevertheless, it does show you just how wacky and fouled up this news media is. And I'm talking about big news networks all the time. Every time I see one of those things, it just makes me boil. If I die, folks, prematurely, it'll be from ulcers. Now, Ezekiel 36 and verse number 26. Here's what's going to happen. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you, and I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh, and I'll give you a heart of flesh. And I'll put my spirit in you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep my judgments and do them. That's what God's going to do in the future. With people who are going to be malleable and are willing to accept it. And all the rebels and the godless people aren't going to be around here when God sets up his kingdom to implement it. Read what it says in Isaiah 66. The slain of the Lord, and he uses the word many, it actually means tremendous. What are we reading the scriptures about the world nations going to fight Christ when he comes? That's what it tells us. What chance they're going to have? Matthew 22, verse number 37. Matthew 22, verse number 37. Now, here's what I want to emphasize to you. I've been talking about the heart here, haven't I? Well, what does God say about your heart? What is your heart supposed to be like with reverence to God? And I'm talking about what your feelings and what your emotions and what your attachments should be and how you should feel. Here's what it says. Matthew 22, verse number 37. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. That's what you should feel. That's what Christ instructs us to be like. That's why the heart is important. It's certainly the seat of emotions and feelings and loyalties and attachments to God. That should be the primary thing. And just remember, as we read here in Romans 5 and verse number 5, Hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, which was given to us. Now, if that Holy Spirit is in you, then God's love is in you. And if God's love is not in you, something is wrong. Now, I'm not talking about a sloppy type of emotional, slobbering type of thing you find to go on with so many people. I'm talking about a kind of common sense reality and the kind of devotion and dedication to God first above anything else, and a love for God that exceeds everything else in your life. That's why the heart is so important.